On lifted his head in pride and brought forth a good day. Debate between winter and summer. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you're a newcomer, welcome. Please like, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff. And please avail yourself of our backlog of episodes. And to our returning listeners, thank you so much for joining me, as always. Now this week, we're going to be talking about early Sumerian religion and kind of the earliest versions of their myths and their gods. We will also talk about what they told each other, and so tell us about the history of the region we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, and how those subjects are related to each other. We're also going to be going over some of our first major written sources, what's good about it, what's bad, and how useful is it really. And I'm not going to cover the Sumerian written language too much in this episode. It isn't developed during the course of this season. But I will be talking about the material used to write, though, as that plays a role in our knowledge of the stories and histories I am about to relate. Now, this episode will probably end up turning into a multiple-parter. I thought, two episodes, but on kind of like collecting all my notes and what I wanted to kind of go over, as I'm going over it, I was like, this might end up being a three-parter, but we'll just have to wait and see. But first, though, when the Sumerians and their immediate literate neighbors and successors wrote everything down, they used a material they had in abundance, clay. Now, the clay was then molded, usually into a tablet, though sometimes they would use slightly different shapes. And it was kept moist to allow marks to be made on the surface using another material they had in abundance. Then this was usually done with a stylus created from the end of reeds that were dried out, and the ends would be cut into a tool to make the shapes that they used for their writing. Now, once you wrote down and you were done, you would leave the tablet out and let it dry. One of the strengths of using clay is that you could reuse tablets created in this way. You could just wet the clay again and then smooth it out. And if you wanted to make it a more permanent and sturdy record, you would fire the clay tablets in the kiln and harden them. And this also happened accidentally. Sometimes when buildings caught on fire, they would occasionally cook the tablets, things like that. And these were fairly sturdy though with poor handling and time, they could still be broken into pieces even if they were fired. Chiseling into stone was also done in Mesopotamia, though these works tended to be bigger and attached to more monumental structures. Now, most of our knowledge of Sumerian religion and myth actually comes from tablets or other shaped clay. This makes sense. We have far more of them than stone monuments. And I couldn't get an exact number for Sumerian writings written by Sumerians, but for ancient Mesopotamia as a whole, I have seen estimates vary, but the low end estimates that we have 500 pieces or whole cuneiform tablets. The high end puts us at around 2 million. The estimates for how many that have actually been translated is at most 100,000. Some of those may not have been published to a massive audience. Some of these things might include lists, like simple lists or multiple copies of the same works, etc. The reason for this is that a lot of tablets have been broken or fallen apart. Thankfully, in most cases, the pieces are close by to each other. However, that isn't always the case. Apologies for that cut there. That siren was going very loud. What's more, tablets typically were discovered with other tablets. So if you can find a room with 100 tablets that have all broken into 5 or more pieces, well, it can take a while to sort through the pieces and match them all together, especially if the markings are worn down or if the smaller pieces get destroyed. Then you have a situation where there might be tablets written in different languages stored together. There might not be enough context on some pieces to figure out whether this is part of the Akkadian tablet or is it Sumerian. So it's partly why so few have been fully translated. And you might be wondering, well, why are these different languages stored together? Well, even though Sumerian falls out of use as a spoken language by everyday people, it remains kind of a liturgical language, similar to how Latin did for the Catholic Church in the early medieval period. So, you know, there are people writing in Sumerian or as part of like a religious function, but it's actually being written by Akkadians. And they would also store old Sumerian tablets written by the Sumerians, and they would make copies of those because they considered them important for some reason, what have you. Now, in terms of things that we've translated, they fall into rough categories. Things like letters, lists, general records, communication, what have you. There are works of what might be considered early types of philosophy containing maxims and things like that for living. There are also information about plants and animals, educational subjects that are collectively called wisdom literature. There are also laws. There are hymns and songs, though sadly the exact melody and arrangements and accompaniments for most of these are not known. I think the earliest song that people have been able to kind of piece together in play is from around the 1400s BC, so well past the Sumerian period. It is known as the Hurrian Hymn Number 6 or the Hurrian Hymn to Nikkal. You can look it up on YouTube. There are various people, you know, playing supposed reconstructions, or at least theoretical reconstructions of it. We also have poetry, which could also have had music played in some cases, though there were, of course, no set tunes or instruments for any of those. And then there are also narrative works, some of which are poetic in scheme, but they tell historical or religious events, or in some cases, both at the same time. It is from these that we gain most of our knowledge about Sumerian religious beliefs, though, as we will see, the intention of most of these works was not to impart this knowledge, so that's kind of a happy coincidence for us. Usually people reading this stuff would have a much deeper knowledge of the subject than what we are, you know, than what we have for it, I guess. One of the most popular, or I guess maybe one of the most common found forms of Sumerian narrative literature are called the disputes or debate poems. They're referred to as poems because of their structures, though in length and purpose, they're actually closer to short stories. And I've quoted a couple of them before and at the start of this episode. These follow a fairly straightforward formula. There's an introduction of two characters. You're informed a decent amount about the two disputants. Sometimes they're animals, tools, people, or even gods. Once this segment is over, the two get into an argument over who is more important or prestigious. And once they lay out their case, a third party makes a judgment and said, this person is the winner. And sometimes this third party may not even been mentioned or... No, you might not even know they're being there to witness the debate. Just appearing and saying, so-and-so won. Now, sometimes these are a little more fleshed out, and two more segments were added, so you can see that written storytelling was evolving. The reason why the two debaters are arguing is actually laid out between the introduction and the dispute. Then there would also be added scenes explaining how the judge was brought in to decide the debate. Still, though, you know, the basic formula is the same. And in these stories, we get decent glimpses into the Sumerian worldview and their understanding of these competing cynosure. That understanding includes some history of the disputers and judges. And from these stories, we hear praise for the deeds and of gods like An, Enki, Enlil, Inanna, and others. And sometimes these tidbits are our only source of certain aspects or traits of deities. Or they might tie in certain characteristics or domains a god possessed that we might not make, but the Sumerians would. And we might make connections that they wouldn't. So I'm going to read part of some translations of a few texts, but that's probably not going to happen this week. We'll just have to wait and see. But that is going to be something that we'll be doing next week and going forward in time. So right now, though, I am going to talk about the gods of the Sumerians, who they were, why they were important, and their history. I'm also going to try to stick to the Sumerian versions of these deities. When other peoples arrive into the area or supplant the Sumerians, they will adopt these deities, and they will change certain aspects of them or add new gods to the stories. Though I should add that the Sumerian religion does evolve on its own terms, and some of the changes we see later groups make may have actually happened during the Sumerian period, but we just don't have a record of the Sumerian change. Now, to start, first we have An and Ki, sky or heaven, and earth. Fun fact, the Sumerian term for the universe is An Ki. The Anki. They're the first gods, and in some versions, they're brother and sister. Now, you may be asking, well, how did they get there without parents? We don't have a Sumerian answer. We know later Mesopotamian groups say their parent was the Abzu, or Ingur. And this is the primordial or cosmic waters. This is a sea or spring of fresh water, or like an aquifer of fresh water, suspended in the center of a raging saltwater sea, like the primordial ocean. The area where these two bodies of water splashed and crashed against the other gave rise to the sky and earth. Or in other versions, a proto-sky and a proto-earth called Anshar and Kishar, which is sky pivot and earth period. Earth pivot, excuse me, and then they gave birth to An and Ki. Though there is no record for the Sumerians holding this exact belief, the primary temple for Enki was called the Abzu, or the House of Deep Waters, and that was built in a swamp of a kind of a freshwater lake. And some traditions hold that the waters of the flood receded. Or it was left over from the flood. So, that may be where, the cataclysmic flood that nearly wiped out humanity, some cases, that's where it's receded to. It went back into the Abzu, that's where it actually left from. And then there are other versions like, no, that's just water left over from the flood. Now, An and Ki were not anthropomorphic, at least not primarily. They did not look like humans. Their primary forms are that of the actual sky and the earth. Now, they were depicted in human form on occasion, though that isn't their primary form, and they did take other forms as well. There is a theory that An was originally conceived of as kind of like a wild bull, known as the Bull of Heaven. And he's always depicted as wearing a horned headdress. Eventually, the Bull of Heaven is separated from An as a separate being that An owns, and he will loan out to other gods for specific purposes. But that's a later invention. Now, these two gods were not usually directly worshipped by the Sumerians, at least that we know of. We don't have a record of any of their cults or temples or any specific prayers to them. Though, again, they may be mentioned in prayers to other deities or in other stories. And these mentions are usually in the form of a hymn or praise, poetry, or something along those lines. There are theories that An was originally the patron of Uruk before being supplanted by the goddess Inanna, And he was one of the gods said to live in her temple, the Eanna. Though there is no evidence of this, and I think the oldest excavations of this temple show that apparently Inanna was always the primary god worshipped there. So if he was the primary god of the city, we haven't found that temple. And it is, you know, certainly possible that An was worshipped in at least small levels at every major temple. From what we can tell, that Eanna was always Inanna's temple. Now, at first, An and Ki were on top of each other. They weren't connected. They were always, you know, body to body, as it were. So they were kind of rolling over and under each other constantly. Eventually, this motion causes Ki to give birth to the first generation of gods called the Anunnaki, something that means the divine offspring or the children of An. They also parent a number of spirits and demons, but they're not really talked about, you know, other than mentioning that they did it. Now, there is no known depiction or list of the entire Anunnaki together, and the sources we have do not agree on anything about them. We don't know their exact numbers or what their jobs as members of the Anunnaki were. Different cities may have counted different gods being part of the Anunnaki, and, you know, so on and so forth. We do know a good number of them, though, and all the major patron gods of the Sumerian cities are members, and I think in virtually all lists, all mentions of them, there's not one city that doesn't have one of the other patron gods in their lists. And they do appear to have a special role in what's known as the Assembly of the Gods. And this was a meeting of all the gods to determine important matters like the fate of men, gods, the world itself. Now, the first and most important of the Anunnaki is Enlil. And he is the god of air, storms, and the earth. The exact name, or the exact meaning of his name is debated. En means Lord in Sumerian, but Lil, L-I-L, is more debated. It may have meant something like Lord Storm or Lord Air, or it could have meant something a little more esoteric, like Lord of the Feeling of Air on Flesh, or Lord of the Spirit of the Wind. He was the patron deity of Nippur, and Enlil was responsible for cleaving An and Ki in two. He's the one that finally separated the two primordial gods. And An carries away the sky, and Enlil takes the earth and becomes its ruler. In some versions, he marries, Ki becomes one of his consorts. His primary temple in Nippur was called the Ekor, meaning mountain house, and was said to have been built by Enlil himself. And it was considered, for a time at least, to be a key point of keeping the sky and the earth connected. It was making sure that they got no further apart or further away. No further apart or closer together. Now, you might expect this would cause issues between An and Enlil, but this doesn't really seem to have been the case. An seems to be content to maintain his rule over the sky and maintain, at least nominally, his rule as chief god. And he does allow Enlil to rule the world as he sees fit. But they do maintain good relations. And Enlil, for his part, continues to praise An and honor him as a wise ruler and his father. And he even swears by An's name in several sources. Probably part of the reason An isn't too torn up with the separation is because with heaven and earth separated, there is now room for not only the Anunnaki to spread out and assume their domains and destinies, but also it leaves room for new forms of life to emerge, including plants, animals, humans. And as you might expect, being the Lord of the Earth made Enlil a very important deity, and he was widely worshipped. And then Lil returned the favor by watching over and protecting mankind. He was a very important deity for those in positions of power. Kings, priests, scribes, things like that. Now, early studies of Mesopotamian literature made Enlil seem like a very wrathful god. He's being cited as a cause in calamitous events like the destruction of cities, terrible battles, all kinds of stuff, natural disasters. But as time has gone on and research and translations have been done, this view has kind of changed. And it's clear that, when writing about Enlil, the Sumerians were very, I won't say, of course they praised him, because if they didn't praise him, he might get pissed at him. But he was the ideal ruler. He was strong, he was just, he punished evil and evildoers. And even after meting out these punishments, he still offers, some level of hope and redemption for those that remained, or that, maybe they had received their punishment. He wasn't going to punish them past the point of, justice. He was just going to make sure that they paid for what they did, and after that, they can continue to live and be good and all that kind of stuff. Now, the next god we should talk about is Enki. He is the god of creation, crafts, wisdom, water, and he is Enlil's younger brother. And as mentioned earlier, he is the patron of Eridu, and his temple was the Eabzu, and his name means Lord of the Earth. And now, this is a little confusing, because he was subordinate to Enlil, who was the actual Lord of the Earth. It may have meant he was the Lord of the Land, or his name may have originally meant something like, or it may have actually been originally Enkur, or Enkig, which might mean something like Lord of the Mound. There is a theory that before he was the chief deity of Eridu, his chief consort, Ninhursag, was the patron of the city. And she was a kind of a fertility mother goddess. She would oversee the births of humans. She was also like a mountain goddess. And the mound may have referred to her. So, Enki may have been her husband, and then as time went on, Enki became more important to the worship of the people living there. There's also the theory that he may have laid with the Abzu after a period of time, and that the Abzu itself was maybe the patron goddess, and the Abzu being a formless primordial being that doesn't have a human form may not have engendered itself to continued human worship, so they picked a god of water who was, very popular and very important, so they may have adopted Enki as their patron at that point. There is also the theory that Enki and Enlil at some point were the same deity, and later on, as time progressed and the Sumerians got spread out, and different people may have called them by different names, that they became separated into two separate deities. I don't think that theory is very popular, though. Now, in terms of widespread worship and things like that, Enki was probably the most popular of the three gods we've talked about. As the god of fields relating to many more individuals than the ruling class, he certainly had more types of people worshiping him regularly. He, of course, being as the god of water, he would be responsible for making sure floods didn't happen too violently, that fish were abundant. As the god of creation, he was important to all craftsmen. As the god of wisdom, he was important for things like medicine, knowledge, magic. Magic's a very real part of the Sumerian lifestyle and everyday life. So, he is someone who that more people than just, judges and kings and priests would, worship. And also, I mean, he was an assistant to the other gods as well. He very often gives good advice to his brother Enlil and sister Inanna. And he shows up in a lot of myths concerning those two. So their adherence probably gave him his due as well. So, but those three on Enlil and Enki kind of form the major triad of Sumerian mythology. Those three are by far the most important deities in day-to-day life in Sumeria. And they're all kind of related to each other. They all kind of follow this kind of social structure and hierarchy. The next big god to talk about is going to be the goddess Inanna. Now, Inanna was the patron goddess, as we discussed, of the city of Uruk. Her temple, the Eanna, was in that city. Now, she's a very kind of difficult god to get a handle on. She has a very wide sphere of influence. She is the goddess of love, of war, fertility, at least in this case, of the more sensual and active acts of fertility, if you catch my meaning, and I think most of you will. But she also has a tremendous, like, she's the goddess of, like, politics, essentially, of persuasion, of seduction, essentially. And the other Sumerian gods, all of their domains kind of line up with one another. So there is a theory that Inanna has been kind of combined with another deity, that, you know, they had maybe a similar name. They had some similar functions and myths, so they were kind of mashed together. One of those big theories is thinking that she is combined with the Akkadian or the Babylonian Ishtar. And indeed, they would call Inanna Ishtar. So there's a possibility that she was a very, you know, early evidence of interactions between those two people. Also, her name is not necessarily Sumerian. There is some question of that. I mentioned when talking about you know, some city names not being Sumerian, and like names for jobs and stuff like that also not being Sumerian. There is the possibility that Inanna was initially worshipped by a people we don't really have a record of, but who were not related to the Samara or Bay cultures. She may have been the primary goddess of a third group, and then maybe that goddess was combined with a Sumerian version, which then kind of came to be combined with Ishtar. So she's very kind of hard to nail down. Interestingly enough, these two kind of diametrically opposed things, like love and war, sensuality and fighting and all this other kind of stuff, a lot of the other Sumerian deities, they kind of marry someone who's the opposite of them in a lot of cases. An and Ki, obviously, sky and earth, they're opposites, equals but opposites. Then you have Enlil, who is married to Ninhursag, who is, he's a god of water, and she is she's a mountain goddess. So they're kind of opposites. Enlil has a number of wives, more than Enki does. Enki is kind of linked with a couple of goddesses too, but Enlil is linked with a lot more. But his primary wife, at least his most important one, is Ninlil, and that's N-I-N-L-I-L. She's not quite the opposite of Enlil, but she's kind of like a more reserved version of him. She's very kind. She's kind of like considered a soft breeze. If Enlil's the storm, she's kind of like the good parts of air, like, or at least the kinder parts of, like, of air and storms and things like that. She's also a mother of quite a number of Enlil's children, and his most important children at that, or at least more of his important children, as we'll get into. Going back to Inanna, though, another issue with her is that her genealogy is a little bit tougher to nail down. Usually she's considered a daughter of An and Ki. She does make her abode when she is not living in her temple on earth. She makes her abode in heaven. She is not under Enlil in that respect, though, of course, she does, give him due deference. Though there are cases of her referring to Enlil as father. Now, some of those traditions, that's it. Explicitly, she's his daughter, but then there's some traditions it's like, well, she may just be referring to him as father is because he's the father of everything. Some versions, she is the daughter of Nanna and Ningal, who I'm not going to talk about this episode because they're kind of not really important in a lot of the myths, or at least in the myths that I'll be talking about in the next week or two. But in those versions, if she is the daughter of Nanna, Nanna is the moon god, the son of Enlil. And in that case, her twin brother is Sin, who is the sun god. Now, in a lot of the older myths, she is explicitly mentioned as being the younger sister of Ereshkigal, who is the queen of the underworld. Now, Ereshkigal is only ever mentioned, as far as I'm aware, and there might be other myths that I haven't read translations for, but I've never seen her mentioned as anything other than a daughter of An. Sometimes I think she is An and Ki, or at least most of the time she's the daughter of An and Ki, but An is almost always listed as her father. Now, if she is the daughter of Nanna, like, again, some versions have that being the case, she is also, in that respect, the twin sister of Sin, who is the sun god. So, again, the different genealogies does not help clear Inanna up at all. So Inanna, very mysterious goddess in the Sumerian pantheon, at least her origins are. She's very popular, as you might expect, for the whole, sex and sensuality and all that kind of stuff, the persuasion, the charisma that comes along with, her favor. In terms of, war, slightly less popular, but obviously you would want to, if you are in war, you would want to be successful. You would also want her favor. She's kind of more the hot-blooded aspect of war. She's not very, like Athena in terms of tactical skill, at least. She's more of a raw power type deity, kind of similar to Ares in the Greek pantheon. And she remains popular well after the Sumerian period. I mean, she's popular well throughout the Mediterranean world. She gets adopted by a lot of other pantheons, similar to Enki. Enki is one of the Sumerian gods that kind of that others adopt well outside of Mesopotamia. There are versions of him, or at least we think, there are riffs on him adopted by places in Cana and other nearby areas on the border regions of Mesopotamia. And Inanna is no different. But she's the primary goddess in Mesopotamian myth. She's got a lot of stories associated with her. Her descent into the underworld is a big one. She's kind of one of the big challenges that Gilgamesh comes up against in the Epic of Gilgamesh, and we'll of course go into that at a later time. So those are the big hitters for the Sumerian pantheon, and we'll talk about the others. I know I mentioned Sind. He's got a major cult center in Ur. Those are the ones that are most important and show up most in most of the big myths that we have records of. Now, next week, I am going to go over some of those disputations and just talk about them a little, just kind of show how they tie in to the Sumerians' view of their gods and how, their domains worked and things like that. I'm also going to go over the Sumerian kings list, which purports to talk about the history of this area during this season, and honestly, before this season, too, if the dates can be believed. Obviously, they can't, at least by us, with our, you know, a little bit better understanding of how time works and our, you know, knowledge of migrations and archaeology. But I'll go over some of that, so I'm looking forward to that. So I think with this, we could probably finish all that up next episode. Worst case, we'll stretch it another week. Now, that being said, I did want to go over my schedule here. There will be an episode next week. There will be an episode in that following week, the week of the, it would be the 9th that we would record. That's a Sunday. And then it would be, Saturday, excuse me. The 3rd and the 10th. So next Sunday, the Sunday after, those two episodes will be out as normal. The following week, the week of the 17th, I probably will not have an episode up. I am going to be on vacation with some friends. I will probably not have time to record an episode. I'll be working on an episode during that week like normal, but as I'm leaving that weekend and will not be back to the following weekend, we'll probably not have one out. So it might be the 24th before I get an episode out. It may not actually be up until mid of that week, so the week of Thanksgiving here in the U.S. So might be a little delay, but I just wanted to let you guys know ahead of time. This is probably going to be the last break I get for the end of, you know, before, you know, Christmas and all that kind of stuff. So I do apologize, but I'm going to keep working. I might have like a midweek episode out at some point to kind of make that up. We'll just have to wait and see. But I wanted you to be aware. But thank you all for joining me. I hope you have found this episode educational and entertaining. And I hope you'll join me next week. I'm also streaming on YouTube, where I also post the episodes, and I'll include a link to the episode on YouTube. Please like, subscribe, rate 5 stars, whatever platform you're on, however you can show positive feedback, please do. If you'd like to reach out and provide any questions or comments or constructive criticism, you can reach me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can direct message me on Twitter. You can leave a comment on the YouTube videos. If you're subscribed on YouTube, I do stream most of the week, and you know, you can drop in if I'm live and say hi and ask questions there. I believe we're at 178 subscribers. We're getting close to 200 there. But yeah, still got a few nights left of kind of the Halloween horror games that I've been playing. And I'm looking forward to doing a few more of those before the month is out. But thank you all again. I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from wherever, whenever you are listening to this, and wherever you're listening to this. Time and space are no object to hoping you have a good day. But thank you all. I'll see you all next time. Peace.